Blog Talk Radio.
You know there's more to this world than what you're told. Paranormal phenomenon, supernatural forces, government conspiracies, alien visitors. Step out of the world you see, open up your mind, and get ready for another round of strange at the Supernatural Radio Show with Corrine DeWinter and Nino Del Padre. Brought to you by PurplePlates.com for harmony, healing, and living energy products for a greater quality of life. Listen up, world. Here's Corrine and Nino.
Dark of night, those small hours I drift away when I'm with you.
In the dark of night,
by my side.
In Excess, by my side, and today is the 17th anniversary of Michael's death. Also coincidentally, well, first let me bring on my co-host, Yvette Scott. Hi, Yvette.
Hello. Rest in peace, Michael.
What's that?
I said rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace, indeed. It also happens to be, and I didn't know this until I was going through my Book of Saints the other night, which I have 10,000 Book of Saints. It also is the St. Cecilia's Day, and St. Cecilia is the patron saint of musicians and poets and singers. So I thought that was very interesting. Also, of course, we know it's also the day JFK was shot to death, unfortunately. But Yeah, it's also my brother Anthony's birthday. So if Anthony, if you're listening, happy birthday again. But
my husband was born. My husband that died was born on this day too.
Oh wow! Wow.
Guess it's quite the anniversary.
Okay, so for those of you who don't know who Michael was, and I don't know how you could not know who he is at this point, but he was a singer for NXS and died in sort of a, you know, there's all these rumors about did he die from autoerotic asphyxiation, because when they found his body, it was supposedly on the ground with a belt around his neck. And, you know, so, I mean, some people say, yeah, he died from hanging because he committed suicide. Other people say, no, he was just trying to, you know, for lack of a better term, get off. He was naked. Yes, he was naked. And so I don't know. Now, you know, there's all these, there's a source I talked to last night who shall go unnamed at the request of the person, but they told me that it was well known in parts of Australia, and we're going to bring psychic chef Pete on in a second to talk about this, and I appreciate Pete for joining us tonight, but some people, you know, so the source said it was well known that Michael was a jerk. This is the first I heard of that, you know. And that he was like a real tough guy, not tough guy, but he was, you know, sort of a troublemaker, so to speak. But I was, I actually met Michael in 1983 in New Haven, Connecticut. It's a long story, but, I had the pleasure of actually making out with him, but.
It was a little bit more than met him. Yeah. There was a little more to that story than you just, like, casually shook hands with him, right?
Right. Well, yeah, just a tiny bit more. But, you know, so anyways, but the last time I saw Michael, it was about 2 months before he died, and he was really out of it, you know, really kind of, you know, seemed to be on a lot of drugs, and I don't know, but it was sad. It was very sad, and but I don't know. Now, you know, I've asked Yvette to kind of look into this a little bit and give us her opinion, and I'm wondering what you're thinking of, Yvette.
Well, I did a lot of reading about him, and it was interesting because I knew him, of course, because I loved his music, and but I never made out with him. But I started reading a little bit about, and so somebody said channeling, but I'm not going to channel him because I don't do that really, but I do get a sense of energy and kind of a state of mind from him. And he's actually not really very talkative. You know, it's like he's private. I mean, it's kind of, this was sort of a private struggle for him. And something that I feel like, energy-wise, that he doesn't really want to discuss so much about the details, you know? But, you know, there was a lot of things going on right at the very time that it happened. And I do believe, from what I've read and how I feel, that he did commit suicide.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I do. I you know, and like I said, I don't channel people. I'm not channeling him. But I just get this sense of despair, some despair and some, you know, just, but I also was noticing that he was on something for depression. And of course he was doing recreational drugs and drinking. And I just wonder about that correlation between that. The same with Robin Williams. He didn't have any illegal drugs or recreational drugs in his system, but he was on, and they didn't name them, but therapeutic drugs, you know. So what if some of these antidepressants that people are taking are actually not helping but harming in some way? That's one of the thoughts I had. about the whole situation. And then if you take into account what was going on to his life, in his life at that very moment, which we can get into, but it was he was in an impossible position. You know, I mean, he couldn't bear being in London because the press was basically crucifying him. And taking, you know, there's like a big fight between Michael versus Bob Geldof, you know, basically, and the press took the side of Geldof. And that, Michael was used to being worshipped in a sense, right? He was used to being thought well of. So that was difficult. He had a daughter that he didn't really expect that he was going to ever have. I don't think. I got the sense that he didn't think he'd ever have children, but he did. And he fell in love with her. I mean, he adored her, and he wanted to be around her, and he wanted to be a family and have a family. But that was basically being taken away from him in a sense, because he wanted to spend Christmas. He couldn't stand to be in London, so he went to Australia. He wanted to spend Christmas with his daughter and his family, with Paula, but Paula had the other two girls from her marriage to Geldof. And so Geldof, at first he says, sure, take the kids and go spend Christmas. And then he said no. And so they actually had to go to court. And he had just, and then Michael had just gotten a phone call finding out that the court had ruled against them coming to Australia. She could have still came, but she would have had to leave her children, her other two children, and just brought in Tiger Lily, his daughter. So, I mean, it put them all in a very bad position over something that could have been easily solved by Geldof saying, take the kids, it's your holiday, take the kids, go have a nice Christmas. But there was such animosity and you know, chaos about the whole situation. And that goes back even further to how him and Paula got together originally, you know?
So that's
part of the state of the mind that he was in. There was alcohol. There was drinking. He called an old girlfriend who came over with her boyfriend, not for any other reason, but I think company. And they stayed until they were falling asleep and couldn't really stay any longer. He sent them away. He said, you guys go on. And then he made several phone calls to people he wanted to talk. He needed to talk. This was a big deal for him. He was in such a state of chaos because of everything that was going on. You know, suicide, yes, kind of a permanent solution to what maybe didn't seem like a temporary situation, but had he been able to get beyond that, it may have worked itself out.
Right. Well, I mean, I also happen to have a personal incident with Bob Geldof and Paula. And I know I sound like Jesus, like I know everybody. I've been everywhere. But
you are a rock star.
It's a strange coincidence, though, because, okay, so at the time I was in New York City and there was some music awards show going on, and Bob Geldof was walking by, and Bob Geldof came up to me and he said, are you in a band? And I said, no, I'm not in a band. And we started talking. And Paula rounded the corner and called me a C-U-N-T. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, their relationship was very, you know, not very cohesive.
And that was another factor into this also, that a sense that I got from just reading. She contributed to the chaos. There was other ways she could have possibly handled the situation with the custody and the child and coming for Christmas and all of that, that wouldn't have put so much pressure on him. But she was at heart a very selfish person because she was in throes of addiction herself.
Right.
You know, and addiction makes you selfish. Addiction makes you do things that you wouldn't normally do, you know. And so she was in the throes of addiction herself, and so she's not making good decisions, and she contributes to his imbalance in his chaos of mind, basically. I mean,
right.
She was, you know, who knows? But, you know, her life ended. And she's where that she's where they kind of got the idea about the autoeroticism or whatever the heck that's called. I don't know. But, you know, that. And I have a theory about hanging as a vehicle for suicide anyway. To me, it's probably the most disturbing of all. You know, when I think about people taking their own life, you know, pills and a bottle of whiskey.
Well, but that him hanging by the belt in the shower, naked, it really lends to everything she was telling people after he died, was that he used to actually strangle her when they were having sex. Because he was something of a masochist, okay? So whether she was making that up or not, I don't know. He was very sensual. And I'm going to bring Psychic P on because there was an incident when he was going out with Helena Christensen, the model. He got into a fight with a taxi driver, I believe, and he lost his sense of smell and taste. And we're going to bring on Pete, and I'm really appreciative, Pete, of you showing up tonight. So can you tell, like, we talked about this a little bit, Pete, about what you thought was going on with Michael at that time.
Damn, woman, I need coffee. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Listen, you're both so right on the money. You know, before we get into that part of the war, yes, you're right. For Australians, Michael was what we call a larrikin. Yeah, sometimes he could be a pretty big jerk. Most times he was just he was a person of extremes. Everything in his life was at extremes. Having a dose of bipolar promotes extremism. I had a lady that I used to work with that was bipolar. Everything she'd done was very, very much black or white. You either were very angry or very sad or very happy. There was very hard for them to have a controlled grey area where it was okay to feel just a little bit of something. And I noticed that Michael, through his life, was very much a person of extremes. He was a lazy sack when it came to the band. All the boys would be pulling all their gear in to set up for the shows. He'd be trying to pick up the next route. I mean, that's Michael. He was always going to be like that. But I really do believe that the pivotal thing that changed his life, because he was a person of extremes. You know, if you take away two of your six senses, and to a person of his character, it is just devastating. The whole aspect of sex alone requires you to have all the senses. You need to be able to smell what's going on. You need to be able to taste the presence of what's going on. And suddenly, back for him.
Right. And yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Pete. But what you're saying.
Yeah, I got a bad line.
That's okay. I mean, I understood what you were saying. So, and even, in fact, Pete, even the band said that since that incident happened where he lost his sense of smell and taste, he was very aggressive. Aggressive in a way that he had never been before.
And that's common with head injuries.
Yeah.
Because head injuries can change your whole entire personality. When I was working in the trauma on the trauma floor, we had a lot of head injuries, and people, their family wouldn't know them, or they would do things inappropriate depending on where the injury is and what part of the brain is damaged. We have different centers of our brain that control impulse or all of those kind of things.
Right.
Well, that's
right.
You got to think, he got smacked in the face. It broke his palate. It broke his nose. It destroyed those two things. If I'm not mistaken, maybe that means he would have copped an injury across the thalamus. Which would considering how, you know, in a lot of ways, he was also a very spiritual person. He had a very good connection with the things, the energies and the flows around him. And that would have cut part of that off as well. So where he would normally be, a clear-headed is not a very good word for Michael, because obviously with everything else that he, But the lines of clarity that he would normally have when he was doing the things during day to day were suddenly very blurred.
Where he could have maybe got beyond the immediate depression and seen that there was a way out of it, maybe he couldn't at that point.
But
well,
but
you've
got
to think,
sorry. I was going to say, do you have the feeling that he actually did kill himself?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I thought about it. After you invited me on the show, I sat down that night, and night for me, people.
Right,
and,
right.
And I went for a wander, and there was nobody present other than the people waiting for him to cross that night when he crossed over. I understand this, people, this whole thing about dying alone, you know, you could be in a desert and you still be surrounded by 20 people. This whole thing about dying alone, bullshit. There's always someone to cross you over. So when people come in and say, oh, you know, my relative went to a dark place and all that sort of stuff, it's just, you know, seriously, it's not right. People make money out of that. So other than the people that were there to take him across, and he got across fine, there was nobody else present. That phone call was so pivotal. Everything in his life, as you were saying, it revolved around that beautiful daughter of his and the whole situation. And Paula will always be a bag. In Australia, we thought she was the biggest God's garbage that ever walked on this earth. There's not too many people that say a nice thing about her because she was very manipulative in her actions.
Totally agree with that. Totally.
Michael was very charismatic. Michael fits alongside all these other people, like for the early Mick Jagger, Tom Jones when he was early, people who have got a lot of charisma, but they don't necessarily have to say a lot. They could just stand with you and look at you, and you would fall into their gaze. And he was wonderful at that. He had a presence. We never forgave him for corrupting Kylie. You'd be surprised how many people kind of go like, but you know, now there you go. There's something that people probably wouldn't realize. I want you to understand that Kylie grew up in Australia's eyes as a sweet little girl next door, neighbors and all that sort of stuff. But she was never, ever going to be anything more than that. And Michael was put on this earth in intersecting lines and teachings to be there to corrupt Kylie, is actually the wrong word, to allow Kylie to find herself and not the image that she had. The image of the sweet little girl next door wasn't Kylie. She was wanting to get out and become something else. And he done it. She was totally in love with him. The day he died, she was totally in love with him. But he done such a wonderful thing for her. But immediately she blossomed into the person that she became. And for the better. But we never forgave him for corrupting Kylie.
Yeah.
But getting back to that thing, that phone call was so pivotal. And that really was the result. Naked, you know, autoerotica, yes, he tried occasionally. Was that whole thing. Michael was very sexual. He loved pushing the bounds of all the things. He loved experiencing everything. You know, as I said, he's bipolar. It's extremes. The drugs dulled things down, so he had to go further to get extremes, to get those bits that he wanted. But that particular night, no. The actress that called over, she's a lovely person, and she copped a lot of flack for it because everybody thought that it was just her that went there, and that she was the person that was there when he hung himself doing autoerotica. But no, it wasn't. He was completely alone that night. And he'd just given up. If it had been any other time, and had he had two sisters that he still had, that he lost, just any sort of thing had changed at all at that particular point in time. He started to hang himself, and I think he just got away from him.
Yeah. Well, I'll never forget that night.
What happened afterwards was even, to me, worse, but it kind of comes around full circle, too, because Geldof. Is that how you say his name? Geldof?
Yeah, Geldof, yeah.
He ended up getting Tiger Lily because, you know, Paula committed to, or she overdosed or whatever. And
right.
So he ended up getting custody, filing for custody and actually getting her. So he took Michael's daughter after kind of being the cause of Michael's demise, but he also lost a daughter this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's so strange, isn't it?
You know, kind of full circle. You wouldn't really say, yeah, you could say karma, if you want to call it karma. But, yeah, it's a full circle sort of thing.
Yes, it is. You know, in Australia, I don't know about the impression for the rest of the world. In Australia, we talk, a lot of people are on Bob's side overall, you know, on the Australia sort of this aspect. Because to us, it came across that basically Michael stole all of Bob. I actually don't believe that because I really do believe that Paula was a lot more... Paula really was the male, the alpha in this situation, and
yeah.
Not Michael. And so for Australians, we saw... I mean, we're not saying that Bob Geldof is perfect or a saint or anything else. In Australia's eyes, it looked like Bob tried to do the right thing by taking care of Tiger Lily because the grandparents really couldn't, you know, was in a position to be able to do it. So, you know, that was the impression we got in Australia. The reality was, I tend to think that Bob done that to get the ultimate revenge.
Yep.
So
I got a real different education and a different sense of Bob from this, reading about all this and
yeah.
trying to feel it out. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind
yeah.
of changed my opinion because I could kind of see how it was playing out and it didn't look good for him.
I know.
No, it didn't.
Well, he certainly looks a lot different to me now than he did when he did Band-Aid.
Or when he was in The Wall.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
At least the Bells grew back.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Quick vote in the chat for him, people. Did Bob Geldof look better with eyebrows or without eyebrows?
Yeah, and didn't
oh, look,
he insure his eyebrows for like $1 million? That was a big deal, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That he took out an insurance policy on his eyebrows for like $1 million. It was back then. It was outrageous amount.
I wish I had done that with my eyebrows because I don't have any anymore. Oh man. Anyways, okay, so I guess, and Pete, I don't know what station it was on, but they did a NXS docudrama about the, you know, Michael's life, and supposedly, I'm not sure what channel it was on, but it was on Showtime here or something like that. It was called, oh my God, what was it called? Never Tear Us Apart, I think.
Yeah.
And so,
I thought the worst number, but...
What's that?
I got to watch some of it. It was,
yeah,
because you're never really going to know the complete truth, but it was reasonably accurate from the stuff that I remembered, you know, because I grew up, you know, Michael and I are the same age. I grew up with his music and all that sort of stuff, so, and the histonics of it all resonated pretty good.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that isn't what his sister Tina said. And I'm going to play a clip of her talking about that documentary. She wasn't happy about it at all. I actually was friendly with Tina for a while, too. I actually sent my brother Anthony to go meet Tina because she lived in Los Angeles and had a hot dog stand at the time. And anyways, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a long story.
A rock star. I swear to God, you're a rock star.
No, I'm not.
Who has a life
anyways,
like that?
I'm going to play this clip of Tina talking about it, and then we'll come back.
Well, Michael Hutchinson's half-sister has slammed the Seven Network's telemovie In Excess, Never Tear Us Apart, as a complete fabrication. Yeah. Tina Hutchinson says the two-part movie left her feeling sad and angry for Michael. She's with us now, live from San Francisco. Tina, thank you for joining us. This is obviously a telemovie that was watched by millions across Australia. What disturbs you the most about what they said about Michael?
Well, first of all, I would call it a docu-fiction, you know.
Yeah.
There were a lot of inaccuracies. I mean, for instance, they have a scene where Michael is, of course, womanized. He has a woman on each arm.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
drinking it up, partying. And Tim, and there was a lot of that, Tim Farris, the much, you know, he's very married, Tim Farris is trying to tell him that, you know, about infidelity, which is a little bit of a joke in itself. I mean, Tim jumped anything that moved. But on top of that, this this was at a time when Michael and Paula had just found out that her home had been raided and they'd found drugs. Now, this is so untrue. This whole depiction is ridiculous. It's designed to make Michael look so bad because, in fact, at that time, Michael and Paula and Tiger were in Sydney for Michael to appear on the Arias with In Excess. He didn't want to be in Sydney at that time. He didn't want to appear in public at that time. He was having terrible time with the British press, but he was doing it for In Excess. And now the band depicts him as being this uncaring womanizer.
That's one of your main complaints, Tina, isn't it? That you don't feel the band has really given him enough credit for the success he brought to them.
That's exactly right. I don't think they have. I mean, he was a man that they've known Michael for over 20 years when he died. I mean, he was 14 years old when he met Andrew Farris and the other two Farris. And, I mean, that's a long time to know someone. You know, to send him up the river like that is just a terrible thing. And the fact is, they were with him in those last 6 months. He was touring with them on a tour he did not want to be on. He told them he didn't want to go on tour. He was seeing a psychiatrist. He was on heavy depressants, antidepressants, and, you know, he was told he shouldn't really be going, but he felt he couldn't let the band down.
And Tina, it's been...
Here they get back at him like this.
It's been interesting, though, hasn't it, how we've seen In Excess, they've climbed to the top of the charts now for the first time in a long time in the wake of the miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
Surely that, though, is a good thing because Michael made incredible music. That must make you feel good.
He did. Oh, it does. I think it's wonderful, you know, that legacy goes on. All of Australia should be, you know, happy about that because... He belongs to Australia, but, you know, of course, it's lining some people's pockets, but that's okay. You know, I just wish they had handled this miniseries differently.
And Tina, can I just clarify, so, because Michael did have a massive reputation as a ladies' man, are you saying he was faithful to Paula Yates, or that he...
No.
Right.
He wasn't faithful to anyone, but he wasn't married either.
Right. But
and he wasn't a womanizer. Let me explain something that, you know, each girlfriend that Michael had, Kylie, Helena, Michelle, and the others, they stayed friends with Michael. Now, somebody has to be very special to stay friends with them.
But he did obviously have a lot of girlfriends. I'm just trying to clarify, you objected to the scene depicting him in bed with two women, which I don't know if that really happened or not, and you said that's not characteristic of Michael.
No, that's fine. No, that's fine. If he did, good luck to him, you know? What I was objecting to is that at the time that they put it in the movie, he wasn't in bed. He was sitting in a bar with Tim, but with a girl on each arm. And he's talking about the fact that this Bob Geldof set the raid on and the whole thing. And in fact, that turned out to be true. We found out later Bob Geldof and the nanny did set it up. But they show Michael as womanizing when all of this stuff is happening. In fact, Michael was curled up in a ball sobbing. And I know this because my mother was there, my stepfather, Mandy Nolan and Rhett were there. And Michael was so afraid that what was going to happen is that when they went back to London with Tiger, that the authorities would jump on them and he would lose Tiger.
So he was in the midst of some kind of breakdown? Is that true?
He absolutely was, yeah.
And speaking
about, this was 1996.
And speaking about Tiger, and you mentioned that somebody was lining their pockets out of the NXS music being popular again. One of the many articles that have been put out has been that the money will go to Tiger Lily. You don't have much to do with her, do you?
No.
Why is that?
No, I don't. Well, I don't. Bob Geldof, absolutely. And I tried very hard in the very beginning. I took several trips over there to see her and set it up with Bob ahead of time. And he's a very passive-aggressive man. He's sort of, you know, he took her out of the country each time I went.
Tina, the one thing that really struck me when I watched it was the impact it had on Michael when he got hit. Was that accurate?
When he got
punched, sorry? In the head, and how it changed his whole persona, and he had these rages.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The main thing was he would complain about that he couldn't. He said to me, "I can't even smell my own baby."
Oh.
It affected him a lot because he was a very sensual man. He was food, wine, everything was very important to him. And his senses were heightened, and when this happened, it was terrible for him.
And
he would fly into rages.
Tina, can I ask, do you believe that Michael Hutchins killed himself, or do you think that he died in an accident gone wrong?
He killed himself. I mean, you know, he was so enraged that he could not get around having his... He had a child in London. He didn't want to live in London. It was very difficult for him living there. The press was just terrible to him. The British press decided he was the bad guy, Bob was the good guy. That always happens with stories in the press. But he just couldn't stand it anymore. He couldn't go out of his house.
Tina...
And he wanted the child to be in Australia.
Tina, I guess the last question we just have to ask you is, how would you like your half-brother to be remembered?
As the articulate, funny, charming, loving man that he was. And to really... Look, those lyrics didn't come from nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
He was a well-read man, a lovely man with a lot of good friends, and he had a very good... relationship with his friends and family.
All right, well,
I want him to remember that one.
Well, Tina Hutchins, the half-sister of Michael, thank you very much for joining us from San Francisco. He's certainly being remembered as a rock legend. The very best album of NXS has hit number one, as Jess mentioned earlier, for the first time in 24 years. And we should probably mention as well that any claims made here by Tina are her views and they have not been proven.
Okay, so there we have that, you know. So she even thinks that he killed himself. But I suppose that, you know, really, you know, it only matters that he's not here anymore. But I don't know.
I think she said it quite well.
Yeah.
She did. It was so well done.
Yeah. I think she said, what more can you possibly say, basically.
If you listen to the resonance in her voice as she's talking, you can tell that she's telling the absolute truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just too bad that he met Paula. That's all I have to say. And it's too bad that he got into that fight, too. I mean, obviously, that lent toward his depression, you know?
Yeah, if he hadn't got into the fight and lost those two sentences, I reckon he would have still been alive today. He would have got past that bit that he couldn't get over.
Well, and just to have somebody that had so much power kind of messing with you, you know, because Geldof had so much power in the things that he did, really, or yeah. allegedly did, you know, it would be hard to get out from under all that.
Right.
Especially if you have a propensity towards depression and other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, did you ever meet Rhett, Pete, his brother Rhett?
No.
Okay. Well, I happened to talk to Rhett one time.
Surprise, surprise.
Of course you did.
Well, you guys, this was at a time when you could actually track down rock stars' phone numbers, okay? So I... I got Michael's mother's phone number, and then, of course, I got Tina's phone number because the mother gave me Tina's phone number. And then I would call them when they were recording at the studio because you could actually do that back then. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But so let me just say this to both of you now. I often have dreams, and I know this is not a big deal, but I often have dreams about Michael. And... he's always just, you know, cool, flowing, just, you know, we're happy, it's fun. You know, and I know that, you know, if you were to look at other radio stations, even on BTR, there's been much talk of women connecting with him on the other side. This one woman even claimed that she's being haunted by Michael. And so, I mean... All right, these dreams mean anything at all, or are they just dreams?
Oh, well. Look, all because if you connect, you know, the dreams are such a wonderful way for people to connect, because once you get to the right state, you know, once you get down to Seta and all that, yes, it's all quite possible. If the link is there and the person is available, it's no different to waiting in queue on a conference call. If the link is there and the person is available, yeah, it's not impossible at all. You could be someone that has capabilities of lucid dreaming, which would allow you to do a lot of that as well. So, yeah, why not?
And, you know, I had a dream after Dale Earnhardt died where Dale came to me and told me that he died doing what he loved doing and not to be despaired, because I loved him like a family member, even though he was a celebrity and I'd never met him. And he came and he also said, the qualities that you admire in me, seek out in other people.
Ooh.
And so, I mean, I you know, there can be, and of course, I never made out with Dale Earnhardt. I would have. But I didn't.
I'm sure.
I had the opportunity.
Did you ever make out with Dale Earnhardt?
But, you know, there can be that sort of visitation, right? There can be that sort of visitation or that connection that you can make with somebody that you've never really, well, you've made out with him, so, but, you know, I mean.
Well, I know, but it wasn't, you know, really. So, Karen in the chat room, I want to do a shout-out in the chat room. Kaylee, Light Mediums here, thank you. Thank you all for being here. It means a lot to me. Chris from Curious Times, we talked till 6 in the morning, my time last night. And I was, you know, I got pretty emotional, and I appreciate Chris being there and her sweetness, even though she would throw up probably when I say it. But she was very sweet. Thank you. And Diane Brighton, and we have a guest call, and Jennifer's Journey, beautiful Jennifer, and Renee, beautiful Renee, love you. I thank you so much for being here. And we, of course, Psychic Chef is Pete on the line, Raven Spirit, Marguerite, Storm Chasing Angel, Bree, Yvette, my co-host, Andy, Jan, love Jan, Karen, one of my bestest friends, and my key heart. So thank you all for being here. Okay, so what was I saying? Oh, all right. So Karen asked in earlier, she goes, what happened after you made out with Michael? I was leaving. And believe me, you guys, at this time, I was an overweight, not very very attractive at all girl of 17. But Michael saw fit to make out with me anyways when I was saying goodbye. So, which meant that he wasn't old. He just was that, you know what I mean? So, I went to kiss him and he made out with me, and then he was holding my hand, and I just backed away, and we just held hands until we couldn't hold hands anymore, and that was the end of that story. But then, of course, I saw him later on and never made out with him again, but, you know, had some fun and hanging out and everything. But, yeah, so that's what happened. I am so silly.
I think it sounds lovely.
Now, there we go. You can actually answer a question for a lot of people. You know, his sister was there going on about how he always remained friends with the people that he came in contact with. Now, at that particular point in time, when you're just standing there holding hands, and then he walked away, you would have had the bonds of friendship. That's how you would have felt when he was walking away. Like, you know, oh, you know, I'll see him again, I'll always be happy with the memory. You know, that sort of thing where it doesn't matter how long a person's away, when you see them again, they're the friend that you know.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the effect he had, and that's where I know that his sister was so accurate about what she was saying and how truthful her words were. As soon as you were talking about that part of it, I could get the same feeling from the winding back what the sister was saying.
Right. Yeah. Oh, boy. I know. It's like, what is there to say, really? But, I mean, I just can't believe it's been 17 years. But I still, Pete, I do still feel that connection with him. And as you just explained it to me, and it was very, I love what you just said about that. But beautiful, beautiful, beautiful soul, I think. And so, anyways, do you guys have anything else to say about Michael? Before I play this clip,
I agree. He was beautiful, mm-hmm. and I'm sorry that, I mean, from the human part of me, because maybe that was what he was supposed to, how it was all supposed to happen for him. But the human part of me is sad that we didn't get to have more of him.
Right. I mean, I think the sky was the limit for him. He probably would have been a great actor eventually. You know, who knows what he would have written, but song-wise, but he did have a solo album too, you know. So there was just no limit except, I guess, his own, which is most of our stories, I think. You know what I mean? There's no limit until we start with the limit on ourselves, you know. So I'm going to play a short clip of Rhett, who is Michael's brother, talking about... and Rhett is sort of the black sheep of the family, supposedly. It was always the black sheep of the family. But this is an interesting take on what happened after Michael died.
Wear the clothes of an 8-year-old.
But first, he's the black sheep of a superstar's family. Rhett Hutchence, the brother of the late rock legend Michael Hutchence, has re-stoked a bitter family feud by trying to cash in on his siblings' most private possessions. Possessions, his mother says, the world was never meant to see, let alone buy. James Thomas reports.
We could live.
His brother was a rock god who died in tragic circumstances, leaving behind a treasure trove of personal memorabilia. Now, Rhett Hutchence, sibling to the late NXS frontman Michael, his brother's personal effects in what some are describing as a tacky attempt to cash in on the legendary singer's fame.
I really don't think I've done that bad, you know, what I'm doing. So I put 20, 30 items on eBay.
Among the items already sold on auction site eBay is a fax from Michael to his then-partner Kylie Minogue declaring his love, a love Kylie has referred to in the past.
He was enormously influential.
Rhett sold the love note to the highest bidder for $400, incurring the wrath of his mother, Patricia Glassop, who went to New Idea to vent her spleen.
I'm shocked and embarrassed he'd be so opportunistic to sell his brother's things in this way. I hope Kylie finds out and addresses the issue herself, because that fax is no one else's business.
Do I have to consult Kylie? Is it any of her business? It's not her piece of paper, it was Michael's bit of paper. It was left to me. I can do what I want with it.
A straw poll in a major newspaper suggests otherwise. The majority surveyed believing Rhett was cashing in on his brother's death.
What a lack of a story, Isn't there anything really worthy putting out there in the news, don't?
Now feel free. You're more than welcome to criticise us.
Rhett is even more scathing of his mother, who disowned him via a woman's magazine.
Rhett's gone too far this time. After this, I don't know who he is, but I do know he's not my son anymore.
I was just a bit shocked that my mother, apart from disowning me, I was a bit surprised that she actually went ahead and did this, because what she's done is inadvertently brought me a lot more publicity than even I really wanted it.
Original handwritten lyrics, Michael's own glasses, and even his clothes are up for grabs.
These are a pair of jeans that Michael actually gave to me years ago, and as you can see, they probably wouldn't fit me anymore now, but so I'm willing to pass those on to somebody else.
Rhett says he'll make close to $10,000 selling his brother's effects.
Why did you sell the items?
Needed some money. I'm in love. I've fallen in love, and I'm trying to get over to Holland.
Most people would save money for a trip overseas from money that they'd earned from working. Rhett says that this is not an option for him.
Unemployed, yeah.
Rhett claims the fire sale of his brother's clothes, documents and knickknacks would be approved by Michael.
What was that line? Somebody sent me a line from one of Michael's songs from Just Keep Walking. Everything, money can buy you almost anything, but everything is nothing when you're dead.
Money can buy almost anything, but anything's nothing.
Rhett would be fully aware that if you listen a little longer, there are other lyrics in that song which aren't quite as flattering.
That's a pillow set that Kylie made for Michael, which I'm going to keep and pass on to either my children or to Michael's, to Tiger.
Rhett says he doesn't plan to sell the pillowcase or the unpublished lyrics, but he doesn't rule out a future sale. His mother wants fans to stay away from Rhett's sale out of respect for Michael. Rhett has little respect for his mother.
She's getting on now. She starts to forget a few facts and figures and things like that. I don't know what she's doing. She's attention seeking. I didn't ask for this.
These are the top stories here on Sky News. It's been confirmed that the body found hanging in a Sydney hotel room is that of rock star Michael Hutchins.
The world was shocked when Michael Hutchins died. It was a sad and tragic story. Even worse is that in his death, the tragedy lives on.
How do you think your brother would react if he knew that this was going on?
He probably would have killed himself.
James Thomas reporting on a very silly...
Oh, my God.
Subtle, real subtle. Would you like some lemon and some salt with that paper cut?
Wow.
Well, Rhett was obviously, I think it's kind of funny because, all right, I don't know. It's kind of funny, but obviously.
You wouldn't have made out with Rhett.
Your parents or the milkman was popular.
Yeah, I wouldn't have made out with Rhett, I'll tell you that much. Although that is a cool name, Rhett. I think that's a cool name, But anyways. So, Pete, what anything else that you can tell us about Michael? I know growing up in Australia, and he actually grew up in Hong Kong a little while, and I can't remember, and he actually did go partly to high school in Los Angeles, which is interesting to me, but Australia was really his home. But, Australians, they just seem so cool to me. I don't know why, but... And even when I would hang out with the band, I'd be like, these guys are just so freaking cool,
Uh, 1980, they're always going to be big. Molly Meldrum, you know, our version of what we would class of anyone as the most influential person in the Australian music scene over the last four decades would be Molly Meldrum. And he's picked so many people that have come to this country or born in this country and gone, they're going to be huge, and been spot on. And all those years ago, just when they very first went from being the Faris Brothers to In Excess, and their very first song that they brought out, it was nothing particularly special. You know, it's one of those songs you hear it once and you're quite happy never to hear it again. But he turned to everybody and said, you watch. They're going to be huge. They'll be an international band and everything else like that. All the makings are there. And he particularly singled out Michael as being the influence that was going to make them get to that point. And we as kids growing up are the same, remembering that I'm the same age as Michael, so growing up in the same the parallel in relation to music. And we just thought they were all dickheads. We just, you know, that you get that whole band where you just look at someone and you just go, mob of tossers. And it didn't matter how good their music was, it was just that persona that followed behind them.
Right. And do you think, Pete, like, you know, Tina was saying, the rest of the band, they didn't actually hand things very well after he passed away. What do you think about that?
Oh, I said right, they didn't. They just, without Michael, the band didn't exist. I know that there's going to be 1,000 people who say, oh, no, that's not right and all that sort of stuff, but it's a reality. It is very hard for a band to come back once they've lost their lead singer. You know, a band is a package. All my three boys are in the music and are in bands and you know, I've been in that sort of scene on a low level for a very long time now. Probably about 15 years of watching my boys grow up and go into bands and I talked to my boys at the very beginning when I wanted to go into music about the core essence of a band. It doesn't matter how good a band is the sum of each presence on the stage and each person brings something to the package. So if you take away the thing that draws the person to the band the most, it's very hard to come back from that. And as you can see, JD Fortune, good boys, reasonable persona, no chance. John Stevens, good voice, had his own credibility in his own right with the band that he used to belong to before, who the name of the band is escaping at the moment. But he had enough credibility to go on, but he would never be the same because no one was going to replace Michael. It's like when Tommy Lee Roth left Van Halen. And no offence to the guy that replaced with him, but was never going to be the same because the personality wasn't there. The presence, the thing that draws people to the middle, straight to the band, isn't there no more. You can't come back from that. And the boys were a little bitter too. That was always a very good
decision. And I think there was feeling of guilt, don't you think? There was some guilt that they weren't as supportive as they could have been, or that they didn't, you know?
They got to the point where it had got too much for them, and Australia didn't want to sound like they weren't caring. They were over it. Michael spent his life, now, if you really want to be blunt about this, Michael, on the negative side of all this, Michael spent his life as a druggie. Every time they're trying to do something, he's either stoned up his face, or he's off doing something he's going to get himself into trouble in the first place. And in the general order, you know, the general pecking order of a band and how the dynamics of a band works, you just can't keep doing it. My son just broke up from the whole band bailed out of the person that set up the band because he was a knob. He was doing things and not thinking about the general order of the band. If you you go or something, you keep the band in the loop. If there's important things going on, yeah, there's got to be that structure, that order. And Michael wasn't a structured person. There was just too much extremes of everything. So after a while, once they got past being teenagers and in their 20s, once they got into their 30s and all that sort of stuff, they were too old to be putting up with what really was childish. So they just couldn't just got over it,
But Pete, did they really have to do that stupid show trying to get the, you know what I mean?
They got offered a deal. Part of that deal meant that there was money going to Tiger. You want to get down to the nitty gritty here. How popular were the band once Michael died? Not that good.
Yeah, no.
And
yeah.
So, they've gone past it. You can't grab hold of the chalice that you had before when there's nothing there for you to bring it. For I lost it. They're chasing the gold coin. They're rolling down the road that they'll never be able to run up to catch. They've gone past all that. So. How do you get to try and get some notoriety back up? How do you try and get something else going? Oh, look, we want to do a mini-series about this. You in for that? Yeah, not a problem. Bang, off it goes. And suddenly now the record sales goes up. They're back in the newspapers again. They're getting a bit of notoriety, trying to claim what they would get back again.
Right.
Instead of just simply accepting what they've got.
A whole new generation's been exposed to his music, so in a way it is good. I mean, people that would know
that. On that aspect, it's brilliant. Because they had some great music. They really did. And it would be a shame for that sort of stuff to get missed.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. I know. We're going to just play a short clip. If there's anyone listening right now that has anything to add to what we're talking about, and that is Michael Hutchins and his life and music. If there's anyone listening that has something to add, please call in at 818-369-0327. And I'm just going to play this short clip so you all can hear Michael talking just for a minute.
What's going on?
Yo.
How are you?
Very well, mate. How are you?
I'm doing very well, mate. If I may.
Mate.
If I may call you mate.
For sure.
You're on a little break. You guys haven't toured in a little while.
Yeah, we haven't toured for about 3 or 4 years, but, we want to take some time off and do the right thing and, just relax and get back into it. And then, it's a suicide to do this, of course, but,
Now, why do you say that?
Suicide. That's just really, these days it's like Warhol was wrong. It wasn't 15 minutes, it was like 5 minutes.
Do you feel the fame slipping away from you when you're not performing? Do you feel it a big difference in your life and in the reactions to you when you're not performing?
Yeah, a little. I mean, yeah, sure, in different ways. I mean, when you come back from tour, it's a bit strange. I mean, we just done 4 months in Europe and 2 weeks here in California, and then we'll come back into the East Coast. But you sort of start pacing at about 8 o'clock every night when you finish 2 years of touring and stuff, and people are like, why are you pacing? What are you doing? And, I'm not on tour, that's right.
That seems like a very difficult adjustment. You're playing in front of 100,000 people, and you're in
manage control. Okay.
All right, let's say it's a festival to help people who are hungry.
A big bar.
It's a huge bar, but you're playing in front of an enormous amount of people, and then you're sitting at home and you got to take care of, you have a family, you have to do regular family things.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I like the difference.
Right.
It's the madness of that.
Tougher in the early days, though. I mean, 20 years ago when you guys were first
starting out. Yeah, well, 5 years in the pubs in Australia, they're not like English pubs. They're, tiled, and they hose them out at the end of the night, and it's macho stuff.
That was my job.
Yeah.
I was the guy at the end of the show.
That was you.
Hose out the tiled pub.
Dangerous. We're good in a barroom brawl, this band,
Do you recall those days fondly, or do you not barely recall them at all? I mean, when you guys first started out and...
Yeah, no, we do. I mean, we talk about, you have a million stories, and you talk about it and laugh about it and cry about it occasionally. And Australia's a big place, so we used to drive from Sydney down to Melbourne. It's about a 12-hour drive, six of us in a car with guitars sticking out the windows, for one show. and then come back again. And you know,
see, wasn't there something, you know, people always romanticize those days as being much more pure than, you know, being sponsored by a beer company and
exactly.
Getting out and doing, you know.
They were. No, they were. It was much more innocent. I mean, it wasn't as much money. I mean, when we started, our record company was in a little shack, you know, now it's a giant, you know.
Right, office. And you helped build that giant office.
That is I go around occasionally and steal furniture.
Right. Any of the favorite stories, like, same band for 20 years, right?
Yeah, same guy.
Which is extremely unusual.
Since I was about 16 or 17, yeah. It is unusual.
Who annoys you the most in it? Is there someone who annoys you the most that is this close to being thrown out all the time? Always this close.
At last, my chance. it changes. In fact, I'm strange. I've realized that I kind of ignored two of the members for the last 19 years. I really did. I mean, it's terrible. It's true. I just ignored them, and it's great. That's suddenly I turned around and went, hey, you're a pretty good guy. So I've been hanging out with Kirk and Gary a bit more lately.
They must like that.
Yeah,
I would think in that band, because you did shoot off into other avenues. You did a lot of acting. You sort of had a bit more of a profile than the other guys. Did that ever present a problem for them when you would go out? What, I saw a movie that you did.
Dogs in Space.
Dogs in Space.
Yeah.
When you went off and did things like that, was that ever difficult for them? They thought, he's leaving us behind.
See ya. I'm out of here. I don't know. I think it must be in some ways, because I think I was a friend of Andrew's. There's three brothers in the band. One of them is Andrew, and I was his friend that was sort of, you know, sulked around the corner, and they kind of indulged me in the beginning. And Kirk was the singer, and I slowly made my way up the little pecking order, and now I just run the show, baby.
So the first night, would you start out on tambourine?
Yeah.
And then one day you thought,
pretty much.
I can take a whirl of this.
I'm really lousy at tambourine, but pretty much that sort of thing. And we just made my way through.
All right, so we've established that you're the good guy.
I'm a megalomaniac.
No, you're not a megalomaniac, but you're a good guy. I saw your lovely, lovely child in the green room. She's just beautiful.
Yeah, she's great. Tiger.
Little tiger. Her tiger, is that her?
We call it, one of her names is Tiger Lily, yeah.
One of her names?
Mm.
How many names does she have?
Three, I'm afraid.
What are
she
names?
Can choose one. Heavenly, Hirani, Tiger Lily.
I think she might choose Tiger Lily.
Yeah, she'll stick with that probably.
Did you say Heavenly?
Yeah, Heavenly.
It's a good thing she's a girl, because if she was a guy, she'd get her ass kicked.
Yeah, Sue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They would do something like that. In the days before then, though, here's what I'm interested in, because being a regular guy, comics, first of all, admire rock stars greatly, because we aspire to that.
That's interesting, because I think it's the other way around for me.
Is that true?
Because I know a lot of... I got a lot of friends in Australia who do stand up or comics, and they're all, well, not very well. You know, they're all very serious or disturbed, and I think that's how it all comes out. You know, it's a way of dealing with the world, and it's a bit the same for us. You know?
Right.
So we have
that
in common.
Yeah, it is similar, but I think what we admire about rock stars is the charisma associated with it.
Mm.
And that we have sort of a theory in the comedy world, and I'm not sure if I can say this, but it is late at night, and that is that the world's worst bass player.
Yeah,
gets laid more than the best comedian.
Right. You know, you're probably right. Yeah.
Because that is, it's rarely at a show where a comic opens up for a band where the groupies are going,
wow,
man, you're funny.
You are so funny. Where's that bass player?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that, when did that get tiring? In the 20-year progression, when did that get tiring? That idea of just, I'm living
the comics opening? Or
no, the decadence. The decadence. The decadence.
I don't know. I've always sort of decadence. I think you have to find your own way through that. You really do. And if you become sort of some cliche sitting around a hotel room, and you know, the whole groupie thing, I never got into. It's. I don't like all that. I'm an elitist when it comes to decadence. That's what it is.
I'm the exact same way.
Exactly. I know, and we're going to hang out tonight.
give me boxer shorts and a big bowl of
you know what I mean?
Cheetos, and I'm just...
And a pizza and...
Oh, if I had groupies. You missed an opportunity, mister.
I know, I should have just had your number back then. I could have
No,
down that way.
Oh, you love him. He's my short, funny Jewish friend.
Funny guy.
Really? Yeah. We're going to come back with Michael Hutchence. The album is Elegantly Wasted. Give us a call, 1-800... Michael Hutchence of NXS, and we've got Danielle on the line from Woodmere, Long Island.
Danielle?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you? I want to know if marriage has calmed you down since your earlier days when you first started.
I'm sorry?
If marriage has calmed you down since your earlier days when you first started out.
Your marriage calmed you.
Marriage calmed me down? No, not really, not at all.
Quite
the opposite. Firstly, because I'm not married, I live in sin.
Ah.
And
no,
not really at all. I don't go with all this this thing about, you know, you got a baby and you got married. No, that's it, man. Yeah, see ya. We'll
right,
go hang out
done,
there. But
man.
I don't go with all that. That's, you know, the hours are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a baby. And I think you just have to, you know, it doesn't make any difference. I think it just adds to your life, you know, very much. I mean, in the natural process is that I'm actually not that interested in spending every single night of my life till the sun comes up in a bar or whatever. I'm just not interested in that sort of thing anymore. I still do it occasionally, but it's just not, you know.
Gets a little tired.
The whole life, yeah, it's boring, you know.
Right. Does that answer your question, Danielle?
Five
yeah.
nights a week.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Yeah,
thank
see?
You.
You got to balance
thanks
it.
Thank you, Cole. Yeah.
You know what I'm always curious about on the outside?
Mm.
You watch MTV or VH1, and they go through this huge thing about rock and roll and fashion and how they're inexplicably tied together.
Linked, yeah.
And I just watch it and think, I don't know what the hell they're
talking about.
You just see all of a sudden somebody comes out in like leather, kind of like a knight's outfit, and there's loud music, and you go,
that's rock and roll.
Right.
Yeah, well, there is and there isn't. I mean, it's a lot of stuff is taken off the street. It's not so much people in bands. People in bands are possibly the worst dressers in the world. It's the people in on the street that are going to little clubs and stuff. That's where a lot of ideas get taken off the street. That's really where it comes from, I think.
Right, and the fashion. The other thing in the music world, music feuds, the rock feud.
Rock feud.
The big one now, Oasis Blur.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Again, they cut each other up, and it's it just seems like an incredibly indulgent.
It's kind of over now because they're just tired of it in England. But I live in London, and boy, yeah, they pit them against each other, and they sell a lot of magazines doing it. Basically.
So it's basically a marketing tool more
pretty
than anything
much,
else.
Yeah.
Because you know how we settled it in the old days back in Jersey.
Yeah.
If I may say.
Same in Australia.
Battle of the Bands.
Battle of the Bands.
Do you remember that?
I thought you were gonna say. Punch the...
No. Fight. Battle of the Bands. You get ten bands together. Did you guys ever have to go through that in Australia?
No, never did a Battle of Bands. Sorry.
Never?
Never. Promise.
And then the winner would get, a mirror
get
with Bon Jovi's picture
on it. Yeah, a microphone. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a plastic one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, we used to have... Not Battle of the Bands. We used to have... I don't know. Yeah, no Battle of the Bands.
None of that. Is your songwriting more mature now as you've gotten older? I notice a lot of bands as well, they get famous, and then they write the It's Really Hard to Be Famous
album.
They
lose it. One, yeah.
Yeah.
This is really tough.
Yeah, exactly. The album where all the songs are like, my life is mine, you can't steal my soul. And you're just like, what the hell happened?
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. The problem is... All the angst and stuff, I guess you kind of learn to replace it, you know, you get an older angst or something, you know, you still have passions, and hopefully I do, and things that, you know, I really believe I have to put down into music, I still do, and there's been moments where I haven't, and I know I've been...
Did it come easier in the early days in terms of writing?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how working in a factory for 12 hours from 5 a.m. and not being able to pay the rent, how many good songs you can write during that process.
And still the inspiration. It's not...
Yeah.
Because I find that when I'm writing comedy now, I have to sit down and really try to bang it out.
Yeah, because you get a pattern, and the problem is you get a habit, and you get tricks, and you have to be wary of your own tricks that you start repeating, and you have to move away from them. You know.
Is this album the best work you guys have done?
I think it's some of our best, definitely. You know, I think it's fresh. It's hard. I mean, when Andrew and I were writing, we did something we haven't done for so long, which is like since we were 12. But we just rang each other up and say, okay, weekend here, weekend there, over 9 months. You know, not like here's the month where you have to make the record, here's the record, here's the video, and all that. That's why we had so much time off. You know,
right.
And we just as we wrote it, we recorded it, and we just kept most of it. Most of what's on the record is. First takes and
oh really
yeah stuff like that you know
wow so you guys
in
really
bedrooms,
did
you know
want to get out of the studio
yeah took out yeah, exactly yeah
exactly
and we're like for a second hey, let's
see
go to dinner
we're out of here
yeah
no, all right
8 days it was good
we're going to commercial when we come back still can we have no oh
no
all right. I'm sorry where to next where's the next spot on the tour
We finished yesterday in Denver, and we're having like 3 weeks off because we've been out there for a while. And we come back and we start, I think, in Chicago. And we'll do the rest of the
country. Good luck to you. Thanks
for
coming on, Michael.
Cheers.
Michael Hutchins, In Excess. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, and that was Michael talking just a couple of months before he passed away or died. I had a friend say to me, why did they say passed away? Or, you know, why don't you just say they died? I'm like, well, I said, because there's no such thing as death. They passed on to another realm. You know what I mean? Anyways, we have Kaylee, who has called in at my request. Thank you, Kaylee. And Kaylee is an up-and-coming psychic medium, and she's pretty freaking good. And Kaylee, tell us what you just did for us.
I managed to get Michael to talk to me a little bit. Well, not, I mean, I kind of nudged him and said, hey, I really want to see if you could do a message for Corinne. It's not really for me, because when he died, I was only 7 years old. So I never really truly knew the man. But what he gave, though, was a simple message. And I even told him I've been sick, so he'll have to speak up. But he just made a really poetic thing, and he said, please give this to Corinne. For her.
Corinne. It's Corinne.
I know. I say Corinne. I'm sorry. It's Ty.
Whatever, Patrice. Little girl, Kaylee.
Well, no, it's sad in a way that I was really young when he died. You know, I didn't get to experience a lot of these things, you know, being born in 1990. So experiencing him as an adult, it's quite different. But yeah, he just seemed very poetic and very, well, he was kind of mischievous in a way. He kept smiling, and I was like, please stop smiling. Please stop. Because he knew that I was going to, like, he was nudging me to get on to talk and everything, and I'm just like, please stop smiling. I'm really nervous talking on the phone and everything. So, but then he dropped his smile, but then he brought it back. So he's just glad that somebody is talking, or what they would call channeling. And he's still around. The energy is really big right now, and I do believe it's because not only the date of his, I don't call it a death, actually. I call it more of a birth, you know, because we move on. But the date of his death, and also just because of you. And yes, I say Corinne. I'm sorry. It's a weird way. I always mess up on names. That's just how I am. But is there anything you want to ask, perhaps, maybe?
Let me see. Kaylee, I'm not sure. I guess, how is he doing? What is he doing now?
From what he's telling me, and I'm so nervous. Let me ask him real quick. He says that he's been doing more of the arts, of poetry and writing books, and trying to understand his own demise, as he puts it. But he's not saddened by it anymore. He hasn't been for years. And he's saying to live on and not, you know, every time, he says every person's tears gets to him, when every person thinks of him and thinks, oh, why, you know, he says, oh, why, God, did they do this? It makes him pause and reflect. And thus he's been writing more. And the more he writes, the better communication, well, basically understanding of himself and understanding what truly happened. Because he says in the midst of everything that was going on, he had lost his mind. He was not mentally capable of even understanding what he had done. And after it happened, he was like, he was surrounded. But for right now, I mean, I see him sitting, and he's got his legs crossed, and he's got his arms stretched out, and they're sitting on a chair. I don't know if that would be his style. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's relaxed and everything, and he's just very focused on this chat room and this show, and he's just very glad he managed to well, see you move on as well in a way. Not, I don't know how the perfect word would be for that, but he's just very glad to see one his friend doing so well, because he always saw a spark, a light, an energy about you that you would be this great person. And I'm getting kind of emotional saying that, because there's just so much there between you two. And he says he does come visit you, by the way. He tries to do dreams, and he knows that you sometimes question them, but he is there. So with what he said, though, the little message that he did give, it sounded like he was actually kind of, you know, like a poem. It was a reading off a poem. And it's very short and sweet, so I think it's wonderful, you know.
And Karen in the chat room is saying, ask if he's coming back to the planet anytime soon.
He says yes, he is, that he wants to come back for another time. So he is getting, he says something along the lines of, he's being masters and not guides, but basically ascended people are helping him move forward, and he expects himself to be back within, he made a joke, 17 years, because, you know, this stuff, but he did say within the next decade or two he will be back. He will try again at life, and he does want to come back as he were in life. So it's just he wants to do a continuation, you know what I mean? And which will be interesting if he does come back and there is this personality that seems so familiar, and all these things that we know about him will come back in a way, but not the negative things, but more the things that you recognize, and when someone has a past life and they continue on. And again, I don't believe in death. And neither do any of the people I've spoken to. They call it a birth because it's a celebration to them.
Right.
Even the worst deaths that happen in this life, even the worst things that happen, it's still a birth. And so I would say the parting message is set free. I mean, really, he's really saying free a lot, because that's how he felt. Like he could travel and be in these places and see these people, and he felt free. And when
right.
things went down, he felt like he was trapped. So, sorry for the coughing. Again, I'm so sick. But
you should ask him if he's still disturbing Bob's sleep patterns.
I hope so.
He did that for quite a while.
Yeah. I get
revenge is sweet from the other side.
I get a very dislike for that guy from him. So
yeah,
playing tricks on him is a lot.
Yeah.
He plays
yeah.
tricks on him a lot.
Yeah.
And he said it, he said it in that clip. He said, I'm just trying to do the right thing. And kind of isn't that what all of us do? We just try to move forward in life trying to do the right thing, you know?
Yeah.
Right, right.
And for him right now, it seems the right thing is to contact people that he knew in life and also to ascend and then go on to a next life. Because he does feel like he's a humanitarian too. You know what I mean?
Human.
I'm sorry again for the coughing, but I'm still getting over
it.
What now?
He was there when Peaches passed over.
Oh, yeah.
Was he there?
I bet so.
He was.
Yeah.
He was there when Peaches passed over.
Yeah.
He was one of the helpers.
Yeah,
he was. Yeah, not in a bad way. He was one of them that sure that she passed over safely.
Exactly. And what a beautiful thing that is. That on
yeah.
the other side, that there is no judgment,
that there's no revenge seeking, but that there's just love.
Right.
Right.
But there still can be dislike, as in you can be like, I don't really like this person, but they don't attack or have revenge. They may play tricks once in a while on somebody, you know what I mean? But I don't get the feeling from him that he hates, you know, and I think that's the part of him learning now on the other side is to be a much better person. And not that he was a bad person at all. I'm just saying that's what we do, you know, even in this, while we're in our bodies, while we're doing the human experience, that's what we do. And so that's all, you know, that's all I can say. I mean, he's enjoying himself on the other side. And I don't get usually most people say, I'm so sorry, this and that, but I get from him, He just says to let go, you know, and I just asked him for the words, and he said, let go. And I don't know if that makes somebody feel like, oh, well, I'm going to forget him or anything. You know, it's not like that. He's just saying, let go of the death, let go of all the drama, because he's in a better place.
Right. So all of you on the line with me right now, so, you know, I never really thought about how Peaches, Bob's daughter Peaches, how she died so young. I think she was, 22 or something?
Yeah.
And then, okay, so Pete, like you're saying, Michael was there when Peaches died. And so I wonder if in his mind he was like, wow, now this makes sense to me. You know what I mean? Like in a way that it didn't make sense before, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Again, you guys said full circle. It really is. And mm-hmm. I don't say karma because she was a child when all that happened. You know what I mean? I don't believe it was karma because that'd be cruel.
It was karma for Bob, but it wasn't karma for her.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be
It was lovely of Michael to put things aside, to go there to make sure that she crossed over safely. That was him doing the right thing and being very personable, going out of his own way, because he didn't need to. He went of his own way to do that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
and that makes him a beautiful soul, too. Because there's still, some spirits still do have that tendency to be like, well, I'm not going to help because of this and that. But, I mean, I do believe in my heart he's very sweet. And despite if he had anger issues or any of that stuff, you know, I mean, and or the brain trauma that happened, all despite all of that, he's a beautiful soul.
Yes,
and
he is.
Right.
And I'm, because the first thing I ever thought, I started playing his music today, all I thought was, I hope he's at peace now. And he is. And that's a beautiful thing to me, to know that.
Right. Yeah.
Because even if I never knew him, even though I was 7 years old, I didn't even know he had passed, really, because it was such a horrible thing that happened. My parents didn't really, even though I listened to his music when I was little, my parents didn't really tell me, you know. So I found out later as a teenager. And when I found out, it was just horrible. And I never had the feeling it was a sexual thing. I always had the feeling that he, you know.
Yeah,
So that whole sexual thing just gets to me.
Right. We have, Kaylee, I hate to interrupt or anyone else. We have like 90 or 60 seconds left. So I just want to once again thank Psychic Chef Pete. Thank you so much for showing up today. I so much appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And thank you so much, Yvette, also, for being co-host, a wonderful co-host today. And thank you for Kaylee for calling in. And I really appreciate it. And we're going to have to get Kaylee on the show one of these days. And in closing, let's just say thank you, Michael, for being here in our time period and showing us this wonderful soulfulness and
bless him.
He'll
Thanks
be
for
okay.
your music, bud.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, guys, and we will see you next time. I need a shoulder that I can cry on.